This is Jason Block with a WLTI Extra. My guest at this time is an author who has written multiple books on the history of game shows and biographies, and I had it right in front of me, of such luminaries as Bill Cullen, Dennis James, Gene Rayburn, Alan Ludden, and Monty Hall. His most recent book from Bear Manor Media, Gong This Book, takes a look at the 1970s hit The Gong Show. He's also involved in the National Archives of Game Show History and will be appearing at the inaugural Quiz Show Expo this summer. Please welcome back to WLTI, Mr. Adam Ediff. How are you, sir?
I'm quite well. Thank you for having me for this and letting me show for a few minutes.
Absolutely. Now, in all, this is the first time I think you have actually done a book on a show, not a personality. I mean, you've done history books before, but on a specific show. What made The Gong Show a good subject for this book?
What made The Gong Show a good subject for this book was that I was called and asked to do it.
Well, I mean, in your opinion, why do you think The Gong Show is a good subject for the book?
It left an imprint on pop culture that still endures to this day. I think people still kind of know the title Gong Show. I think people, you know, we still refer to banging the gong in a joking way. So it's permeated the language in that sense. And just the fact that it gave birth to so much of what television became later with American Idol, America's Got Talent, The Voice, etc. All of these shows were preceded by The Gong Show, and it was a show that celebrated the good and the bad of new talent and showcased it and put it out there for people to see. And you look at the future of television, and so much of television is that. It's a forum for showcasing good and bad stuff.
I love the word you use, stuff.
Yeah. Fitting. So,
very fitting. For those who don't know about the show and who are younger than when it was on the air, how did the show actually work?
Most of the time it did. The show...
no, I mean, what was it? How did the show... Yeah.
So each episode had a series of amateur and professional acts. They would come out, they would perform their act. They had... This was never really stated on the show, but it was a 90-second time limit for the act. They had 90 seconds to do an act with three celebrity judges looking on. At the conclusion of the act, the celebrity judges would give a score of 1 to 10. So each of the judges giving a maximum score of 10, that meant that your best possible score was a 30. And at the end of the show, the best act of the day won the almost unusable grand prize of $516.32 plus a golden gong trophy. However, if at any point one of the judges felt that the act was not worthy to continue, there was a giant gong behind the judges panel. Any one of the judges could bang the gong and it would end the act right there.
Now, I know the answer to this, but why was the number $517.32? Why was that done? It's a great.
You know what? You say I know this, but I'll bet you don't. I'll bet you don't, because I thought I knew the reason too. You think it has something to do with what the talent was paid, right?
No, the scale. It was not.
Yeah, the scale. It wasn't. A lot of the acts that I talked to remember that they got paid around $250. It wasn't $516.32. And I asked a lot of Chuck staffers about that grand prize number and where it came from. And actually, none of Chuck's staffers had heard the explanation that it had to do with scale or anything. Their memory was Chuck just wanted a funny sounding number for the grand prize.
Okay.
And that was all that mattered. So, yeah, the story that you heard is out there, and it's the story that I thought was true when I went into this. But everybody that I spoke to said, no, it just Chuck wanted funny numbers. So,
you know, and again, that's why you should buy this book, because you learned something.
Yeah.
This was around the time of kind of peak Chuck Barris, because this, you know, he had done, I think, if I remember around the time, he had done The Dating Game, he did The Newlywed Game. How hard was it to get The Gong Show on air?
It was very difficult to get on the air. One of the network executives that screened it turned off the videotape of the pilot before he had finished watching it, and he pulled it out and he turned to Chuck Barris and said, "You should be ashamed of yourself."
Oh, wow.
And then NBC had just had a change in management. Lynn Bolin, who was a pretty famous and infamous name among network executives, had just left the network. She was replaced by a woman named Madeline David. And Madeline David wanted to see if there was something different that they could do for daytime television. She said she wanted to deviate from game shows and soap operas. Let's try to do something that's not a game show or a soap opera. And she screened the pilot for The Gong Show, and she said, well, let's do some focus group testing. And she later said The Gong Show got the worst testing of any pilot that they had ever screened at NBC for a daytime TV show. But oddly enough, her reaction to that was, well, let's put it on the air. And there was one other network executive that supported the idea of putting it on the air. And in so many words, what they said later about it was they wanted to put it on the air just to see what happened if this show actually aired where people could see it. Like
Oh,
it's the reaction was so overwhelmingly negative that it was a morbid curiosity factor. They wanted to put it on the air just to see, okay, what's going to happen if we actually show this?
now that's crazy. I don't think you could do that now. I mean, that's that no, wow. So in other words, the show did shouldn't have gotten out of the pitch room, but they said, "Eh, let's do it anyway."
Let's see it,
Wow.
yeah.
Wow.
And like I said, it was just total curiosity. And
Yeah.
it worked out for them. You
So,
can't deny that.
right. Now, everyone knows that everyone knows of Chuck Barris being the face of the Gong Show for most of its run, but he wasn't the original host of the show, or at least at the moment, because I follow your Facebook page, and there's a very interesting note about that.
Chuck was not planning on hosting this, never had any intention, never suggested himself as host. It was a total accident that he got that job. When the series was originally in development, the host of the pilot was Gary Owens, who classic TV lovers would remember as the announcer on Laugh-In.
Yes,
And
from
the
beautiful
feeling
downtown
was,
Burbank,
yeah.
you know.
And Gary always had that highfalutin way of talking and that very bombastic voice. And the thought was that Gary would play something of a character. And Gary would be this very self-important, grandiose host who would conduct himself as if he was above the show he was hosting. That's what they had in mind. So
Interesting.
Gary hosted
Okay.
the pilot, and the plan was to pitch it for once a week syndication in prime time. That was going to be the plan for it, for prime access time. So they pitched it and they sold it with Gary Owens as the nighttime host. And then Madeline David learned about this quirky show that Chuck had been trying to sell to the networks and it got rejected. And now he was selling it in syndication. And so this leads to NBC screening the pilot. And Madeline David, like I said, morbid curiosity propelled her to put the Gong Show on the air, or compelled her, not propelled her. It compelled her to put the Gong Show on the air. But she decided that she didn't like Gary Owen's style of hosting. It wasn't that she didn't like Gary himself, but she felt his style of hosting was wrong.
Right.
So they told Chuck, you've got to find another host for the daytime show. So Chuck finds, at the time, a local TV personality in Los Angeles, a guy named John Barber. And again, TV lovers from that era will probably know John Barber better because he eventually did have a hit. He was one of the correspondents on Real People.
I was just about to say that. Yeah, because the name just clicked. Yeah.
In the late 1970s, early 1980s. So that was their host. And in fact, if you look at the early advertising for The Gong Show, and if you look at the TV Guide advertisement for the week's premiere when it first went on the air, it's John Barber in the ad. And it was John Barber and all the advanced publicity. Game shows are taped well in advance. They were then, as they are now. They taped five episodes with John Barber, and it was such a disaster that Chuck let him go after one taping. John essentially hosted it like a normal game show host. And in fairness to John, this was such a new animal. This was such a different show. It was hard for anyone to get a sense of what the right host for this show would be, as we just established by saying NBC wasn't sure about Gary Owen's style of hosting. They were really having trouble zeroing in on what the host of this show should be, but John Barber was not hitting what Chuck Barris was trying to coach him to do as the host of the show. So Chuck fires him and he tells NBC, okay, I'm going to find another host for this thing. I don't know who, but and Madeline David suggested, okay, listen, Chuck, if you know so precisely what the show's hosting style should be, you should host it yourself. And Chuck kind of hemmed and hawed about that, but Madeline David basically twisted his arm and said, no, listen to me. This show does not go on the air unless you're hosting it now. So Chuck was kind of forced into hosting The Gong Show. They never aired the five episodes that John Barber hosted. They started the run of the show on NBC with episode six, and that was Chuck Barris's first episode. And Chuck made it click with an assist from Jamie Farr. Jamie Farr is kind of an unsung hero in the creation and the shaping of the Gong Show as we know it.
And he's one of the most famous judges
Yeah.
of the, which will, okay, let me segue into that is, how did he, was his hosting style, or what was his hosting style? Because some days he can be, and I'm going to say it's like he's, high on weed, and then there's another day when he's, very serious. You don't know what Paris you were going to get one day, or depending on the show.
I think the notes that Chuck was trying to hit and that he was trying to get John Barber to hit was sympathetic towards the contestants, but if the judges gong you, that's it. That's it for you. So it was sympathy for the contestants, but also deferring to the judge's decision. John Barber, I had a chance to screen. Game Show Network aired one episode from his lost week in 1999, and then I had a chance to watch the master tapes of the rest of the week. And John Barber would argue with the judges. He would kind of scold them for banging the gong. And Chuck was trying to make the point, no, that's why they're here. That's the name of the show. That's the whole point here. But he would get mad at them. And also, John did not seem aware of the fact that this was being played for laughs.
Right.
And kind of the classic example of that came in episode four. I believe it was episode four. A woman's act was that she played music by blowing into the crook of her arm.
Oh,
Like
yeah.
that.
Oh, like the armpit noise.
Yeah. So she does that for a few seconds, and then the judges bang the gong on her. And John comes out and scolds the judges for not giving her any time at all to perform the act, and maybe it would have gotten much better. And then he turns to the act and says, "Well, I hope you got some value out of being on the show, and I hope their feedback means something to you."
Oh, good
And it's
grief.
like,
That's not
okay,
the
yeah, her act was she was making fart noise, and like when she got gonged, she even said in this very haughty voice, "The judges have no feel for classical music." So even the contestants were getting the idea by episode four. And John Barber just, he wasn't getting this. He thought this was a serious attempt to find great new talent and did not seem to be aware that there was a joke happening around him.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, just the, now. After doing the research for this book, do you think you have learned because Chuck Barris is the most enigmatic producer in game show history? Not many people know what's true, what's false. Do you think you learn more about him as a man?
I think I learned a lot about him. I was surprised by some of the people that I had a chance to talk to. I got a chance to talk to people who worked for the man. I had a chance to talk to people who worked around the man, like the NBC crew, the NBC compliances and practices person.
Okay.
So not people who answered to Chuck, but people who had to be in the building for the Gong Show.
Right.
Talking to the executives who dealt with him, that was a real privilege to talk to them. And one of the amazing strokes of luck that social media has made possible, I found out that I had a friend who was a Facebook friend as a result of another interest of ours, another shared interest that had nothing to do with game shows. But this friend knew somebody who had been Chuck's next door neighbor when he was living in a tiny village in France after he had sold his company and basically went into hiding.
Wow, right.
So,
Okay.
like, of all people to luck into, Chuck's next door neighbor in this remote village of France was willing to talk to me and painted this really touching portrait of a very thoughtful, very deep guy who had a lot going on inside him, and the general public didn't see that part of him. She said, "One of the things that really struck me was I knew who Chuck Barris was, and I knew he had been this very successful television host and producer." And she said, "What always stood out to me when we had conversations when we were both living in France was he never talked about television. It wasn't something on his mind. It wasn't something that interested him. He would never mention, 'Oh, I've got this new idea. I might go back to the States and develop it.'" She said, "You know what Chuck talked a lot about?" She said, "Books." Chuck was a voracious reader, and every conversation they had was about the latest book he had read, and the ideas being expressed in the book, and what he got out of it. And that was what interested him more than anything, was ideas from books.
Do you, I know there have been many books, but do you think down the road you might want to check out Chuck Barris maybe and see if you could?
I've pretty well covered it in this book. I mean, it's hard to tell the story of Chuck Barris without telling the story of the Gong Show. And the other thing, I try to resist stepping on toes that have, of subject
Yes.
matter that's already been dealt with. As an example of this, somebody asked me if I would ever consider writing a book about the history of Press Your Luck. And I kind of said no to that because Game Show Network did the Big Bucks documentary
Which
about the
was fan
scandal,
Oh, that was so
which was
good.
fantastic. And I thought, we got that documentary. We kind of don't need a book now that we got that. Doing a definitive biography of Chuck Barris is not necessary because Chuck basically wrote three autobiographies during his life. Actually four, now that I'm thinking about it in my head. So four books from Chuck talking about his life, plus me writing this book about the Gong Show. And writing this book about the Gong Show, you had to cover the history of Chuck's production company, which meant you had to cover who Chuck was. I don't think there's a need for me at this point to write a book about Chuck Barris. I think the books that are out there, including this one that I'm plugging right now, are
Yeah.
pretty much going to tell that entire story.
So how, yeah, so going back to the show itself. So how were the acts selected?
The acts were selected by a group of staffers called the Shock Troops. Chuck called them the Shock Troops because they saw everything. And one of the sobering statistics that I learned from talking to the Shock Troops, and this, if you watch an episode of the Gong Show, this fun fact will stick with you for the rest of your life. They said the average was for every one act that made it on the show, nine acts got rejected. So a typical episode of the Gong Show.
Oh
A typical episode of the Gong Show had
Yeah.
seven acts,
Right.
which means when you watch any episode of the Gong Show, there were 63 acts that got rejected for this batch that you're seeing.
Okay, my head,
Yeah.
yeah,
So
my
let
head
that
hurt.
marinate. And that's why Chuck called them the Shock Troops, because they had to sit through 63 acts to get these seven for the taping. So they saw some brutal, brutal stuff during their time there. And they. It wasn't a fancy setup at all. The thing that all of the contestants remembered was the absolutely bizarre setting for the auditions. It was called Old World Restaurant here in Los Angeles. And the definitive description I got of it, and it's the definitive description if you happen to have seen the movie The Godfather, but somebody said if you've seen the movie The Godfather, the place where you audition for the Gong Show looked like the restaurant where Michael has to get a gun from behind the toilet.
I know
Yeah.
I got it. I
Yeah.
understand.
So that was where you went for your auditions. It was this condemned building in the middle of Los Angeles, and Chuck had his staff set up a spot where people could audition for the Gong Show. So you came in there, you did your audition for 90 seconds with a video camera rolling and with the shock troops watching you, and the shock troops would kind of make some judgments and keep some notes, and they would very quietly turn off the camera if they just immediately got a sense that this act wasn't cut out for the show. And then after all that, they would kind of splice together a reel of acts to for Chuck to look at and to go through notes with him. And then there would be a round of callbacks. And this was a thing that surprised a lot of the contestants that I talked to. They were surprised at how involved Chuck actually was in the process. They were very surprised that Chuck was actually there for the second auditions. Everyone just figured it was going to be staff members and that they were only going to see Chuck when the show was taping. They said, no, we came in there and Chuck was actually there. We were auditioning for him, and that really surprised all of them. So you performed for Chuck, and if Chuck thought you were fit for the show, he booked you. And it wasn't just the fact that he was there. Chuck would talk to you and he would get to know you while you were auditioning for the show. And then Chuck was also involved in the rehearsals for the Gong Show. Every act comes on stage and performs their act, so the audio guys and the camera guys are ready and can figure out what shots and what they need to do with the audio. And there's surviving footage of some of the rehearsals, and you can see even there, Chuck is very, very involved. Chuck wants the audio to be exactly right for one act's performance, and Chuck wants to make sure that the camera shots are all right. There's one act where he notices that John Dorsey, the director, has missed a couple of key shots, so he just comes on and says, "Let's do that again." And he has it run it over again, but Chuck stops before they start the act, and he tells the act, "Listen, you did a great job. Everything you did was exactly right. We're doing this over again for us. We were the ones that made the mistake." And he's very, very assuring and very, very comforting to this act and making sure that they know that they didn't screw anything up. And then getting a chance to watch the actual episode, this act gets gonged, and the reaction to the sound of the gong is they just burst out laughing and they walk over and they hug Chuck. Because by that point, Chuck has kind of formed a friendship with him. They feel very, very close to him. Chuck was so warm and so inviting to the contestants who were on the show and very encouraging to them. And they couldn't feel bad about the fact that they got gonged because Chuck received them so warmly all the way through the process.
So very quickly, you pointed out that the reaction of to the public was not exactly as positive as we thought it was going to be. But also Barris did a fig I loved how he did something almost 50 years ago that is ubiquitous today, which was put a drag queen on the show during the anti-Anita Bryant show. Tell us about that. That's just it's very interesting. That was a very interesting.
Anita
That was
Bryant was a very public, very outspoken, homophobic singer, who was getting a lot of press attention for the remarks that she was making. And so Chuck Barris did this on the daytime and the nighttime show. He did an episode with a huge sign on the stage saying it's not Anita Bryant Day. And for the daytime show and the nighttime show both, he dedicated segments of the show to Anita Bryant where he had drag queens come out and perform dances and songs. So that was the Gong Show firing back in the 1970s and making a statement then, which by no means should still be controversial, but somehow still is. But that's what I love about the Gong Show is you see the occasional comments from people saying, you couldn't do this kind of show today. But what was awesome about it when you look at it now was everybody was welcome to be a part of this spectacle. Yes, it was crass and it was un-PC and there was dirty humor and
Yes.
you could.
So
And
much.
there was a lot of questionable taste. There was, there just all kinds of things that you have a problem with, and I can understand having a problem with. But what you notice is, all this dirty, naughty, disgusting stuff they're doing, all this offensive stuff, includes every color of the rainbow. So, yeah, it was, like I said, it was un-PC, it was raunchy, it was tacky, but everybody was welcome to be a part of it.
Who were some of the acts that became famous after, the show?
So Chuck kind of encouraged professional acts to be on the show, especially particularly improv comedians, because there was a constant fear of his that the show would run out of acts, that people would stop coming up with fun things to do. So the show kind of quietly encouraged improv comedy troupes around California to come up with acts to come in and audition for the show. And very, very unlike most game shows, there was no limit on the number of times that you could be on the show. You could be on the Gong Show however many times you wanted. The only restriction they put in place was you had to do something different every time you auditioned for the show. And because of that, Paul Rubens, aka Pee Wee Herman, was a contestant on the Gong Show 14 times. He
Did he
was
ever win?
At least he won at least twice. I don't know the exact number, but he won on the show at least twice. But he was on a total of 14 episodes, and a number of members of the Groundlings, which was the troupe that Paul Rubens was in, were also part of Gong Show acts. Phil Hartman, who was a member of the Groundlings at that time, was a contestant at least once. And somebody on Facebook pointed out, and I hadn't noticed this until somebody on Facebook had pointed it out, John Paragon, who was Jombie on Pee-wee's Playhouse,
Oh,
is Pee-wee's or Paul Rubens' performing partner in one of his 14 appearances on the Gong Show. I hadn't recognized that. So the other key thing about this is not only were you encouraged to appear on the show over and over again, but Chuck, as a result of encouraging professionals to be on the show, if you had union membership for Screen Actors Guild or for AFTRA, which is the Radio and TV Performers Union, you were obligated to receive royalties for your appearances on the show if it ever went into reruns. And the really remarkable thing, and a few contestants spoke to this, was Chuck would actually sign you up for membership in those unions. Now that's not just being, but you really have to think about that. Chuck is costing himself money by doing that. But Chuck would actually fill out the paperwork in, and in at least one case, according to one of the people that I interviewed, one of the ex-contestants, Chuck paid the entry fee to get them in the union. Out of pocket. Never
wow.
asked for reimbursement, never asked, but he would actually pay and help these people get into the unions, the performance unions. So when Chuck sold the show into reruns, everybody got a windfall, and you're paid according to how many times you had been on the show.
Right.
And the way the royalties works are it's 100% of what you were paid the first time the show is rerun. And Paul Rubin said at the time he was actually looking for a day job because being a performer was not paying the bills, and he was looking for something to support himself, and he got just a huge windfall from being on 14 episodes of The Gong Show. He got a giant royalty check right after Chuck sold the rerun package, and Paul Rubens lived off that money for a while as he was developing the Pee Wee Herman stage show. So
and that,
he
that
got a financial boost, and we may have gotten Pee Wee Herman out of that.
Wow.
Yeah.
I want to switch gears just a little bit because we have a little bit of time left. You're also involved in something that I think is just cool as hell. I interviewed Bob Bowden about a year and a half, 2 years ago about this, which is the National Archives of Game Show History at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York is a museum dedicated to play in all of its forms. So there are exhibits dedicated to dollhouses. There are exhibits dedicated to superheroes. There are exhibits dedicated to model trains. There are exhibits dedicated to video games, exhibits dedicated to just all kinds of toys. So play in all its forms. It was right before the pandemic started that Howard Blumenthal, who, if you're a voracious reader of the credits, you might remember that he was involved in the development of MTV's Remote Control and the development of Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego.
Ah.
And his father, Norm, had been the producer and the rebus puzzle artist for the original Concentration for 14 years.
Nobody important.
he was the one that first put out the feelers and said, have you thought about doing anything related to game shows? And the Strong Museum said, we've talked about doing that, but the problem is we don't know anybody in that world. And Howard stuck out his head and said, now you do. And Howard looped in Bob Bowden, and Bob, I am grateful forever, looped in me as kind of an archivist and a researcher. And so what we're now doing is we are reaching out to people who have worked in the game show world in all areas, all job titles associated with game show production, and we're just basically asking them for their stuff, anything that they say.
There it is.
And as I've said so many times before, and I'll never get tired of saying it because it's so true, what we've learned from this process is everybody who had a long career in game shows has one thing in common, and that is they all have a wife who has been begging them to clean out their basements. We reach out to these people who had long careers in game shows. Did you save any of your stuff? Oh, did I? And they're turning over pieces of the sets. They're turning over large props. They're turning over binders filled with used question material. They're turning over just all kinds of things that they hung on to for years and years and years.
That actually leads me into my next question. What has been some of the coolest artifacts that have been donated or collected so far?
Yeah, the tricky thing here is there's a thing that I'm not allowed to tell you about yet.
Okay. Something that has been,
yeah,
that we have
there's
seen.
One great answer that I can give you, but eventually down the road. But for the moment, what I can say is we have nearly the entire Ray Combs era set of Family Feud, which was actually, and I didn't realize this, I always assumed they just used the same template but rebuilt it. But no, the Ray Combs set of Family Feud was actually the refurbished Richard Dawson set. They ripped the guts out of stuff and replaced some of the lights, and they put, you know, red felt over it instead of brown felt.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same set pieces, but we have fundamentally the entire Ray Combs set of Family Feud, including the Fast Money board, which Randy West had in storage for years and years and years and turned over to us, and we're thankful to him for that. Some of the other goodies we've gotten some of the decommissioned pricing games from The Price is Right. The museum now has the buy or sell game, and it has the 1986 version of the Any Number board.
Okay. That's the second one, I think.
The one that they built to accommodate five digits.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And we've also, we've got some of the decks of cards from Card Sharks. We've gotten some of the decks of cards from Gambit. We've got not the original Match Game sign, but the recreation of it that was done for the Game Show Marathon series on CBS, and the question machine from that one, which I'm amazed I didn't wear that out because We got that out of storage, and I just pulled on the levers of it over and over again to make the placards change on it. I could not stop playing with that.
So this is, I'm going to ask you the dumbest question, but it's important. Why do you think the genre of game shows should be celebrated with its own museum?
You know, the genre of game shows should be celebrated because it is a part of our culture. It is a part of who we are. And it's a part of, I don't like to say all of our lives because, oh my God, that's so generic and it's so cheesy sounding. But you look at the comments of people who have fond memories of, oh, I watched the show when I was homesick from school. I used to watch the show on summer vacations. So there's that element of it. There's also an element of how it reflects the culture around it at the time. You see from the prizes offered, you see from what the contestants reveal about themselves, what was valued in the world at that time. And you learn from the question and answer material, what kind of information was valued at that time. Like you go through a 1955 episode of Tic-Tac-Toe or before anyone fact checks me. No, that show was not on the air in 1955. That was a misspeak. An episode of Tic-Tac-Toe from the 50s, let's say, you get a feel for what was popular, what was trending, what was considered important knowledge, what was considered valuable knowledge from the questions and answers asked at that time. And you listen to the question and answer material on a show today, and there are questions from the 1950s that we would still ask today, and there are some that we would not ask today because that sense of what's important has changed. So the content of a game show is its own time capsule, basically. It gives you a sense of where we were as a people at all times. It's just this constantly updated record of what the trends were, of what the fashions were, and of what mattered.
What's also very interesting to me, and you're absolutely right, is that I love to see what was important to win via the prizes that were offered. I mean, when you watch stuff, you're just like, oh wow, that was big. Or when you see something on like a 1950s Price is Right to a 2023, 2024 Price is Right, different yet the same in a way. And it's just great. So just a couple of minutes. So if you could just also, you know, we've got just the last thing, just say anything you want, plug the book. Again, it's called Gong This Show.
Gong This Book.
Gong This Book, damn it. Gong This Book. So just talk about it one more time.
Yeah, the new book is titled Gong This Book. It is available, as all of my books are, on Amazon and on barnesandnoble.com if you'd rather shop at Barnes & Noble. Also, if you'd rather shop from an independent bookseller, and by all means, please do that. Just doing a Google search for my name and the title of the book should be enough to bring it up. I found out there's a bookstore in Australia that's selling my book called Better Read Than Dead, which is the best name for a bookstore I've ever heard in my life. So please buy a copy from them just to support the name of that that place. So barnesandnoble.com and amazon.com are the two best, most prominent places to buy my book. But short of that, just any book selling website, do a search for my name, Adam Nediff. The last name is NEDEFF. And you ought to be able to find whatever I've written.
And of course, as I said, I want to personally plug, you have done some amazing biographies on Gene Rayburn, Monty Hall, Dennis James, Alan Ludden. You have become the preeminent game show author. And, you know, again, thank you for just spending a few minutes with us. This is Jason Block here for WLTI Extra with game show author Adam Nita. We'll see you next time, and we'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye.
This program.